Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, negotiators from 12 countries from around the Pacific Rim are in Salt Lake City, continuing their negotiations around a multilateral free trade agreement known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The countries involved include top U.S. trading partners like Japan, Canada, and Mexico, as well as emerging economies like Malaysia and Vietnam. Together, they account for 40% of U.S. exports, meaning the TPP could have more far-reaching effects than NAFTA, and the door has been kept open for China to join the talks. News reports suggest that closed-door discussions revolve around market access, environmental and labor issues, intellectual property and public procurement, but it's hard to know exactly what's being discussed or decided on since the negotiations have been conducted entirely in secret. Even members of the U.S. Congress have been allowed only to view selected portions of the documents under supervision. However, negotiators have had input from more than 700 so-called cleared advisors, representatives of industries with interest in the regulation of intellectual property, music and entertainment, telecommunications, software, pharmaceutical companies. Last week, we got some idea of what they've been advocating for thanks to a draft chapter of the TPP released by WikiLeaks. On today's Your Call, we'll dig into the revelations from the leaked TPP documents and try to get a handle on the broad implications of this deal and how the Obama administration is negotiating it. Is this the way trade agreements should be negotiated in a democracy? How did it get this way? And how can the voices of citizens and their elected representatives return to the process? Amplifying the public's voice in Washington is the mission of Public Citizen, and joining us for the hour is Ben Beach, Research Director with Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And among the folks who were most alarmed by what was in that leaked chapter of the TPP, that draft document that came out last week, are advocates for a free and open internet, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Myra Sutton is a global policy analyst at EFF. She works on their team monitoring and advocating around emerging technology policy worldwide. Myra, great to have you on Your Call.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And given that this is a trans-Pacific agreement, it's important to understand what this deal looks like from the other side of the Pacific. And to help us get that perspective, we're joined by Vinod Agarwal, professor of political science and director of the Berkeley Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Study Center. And he joins us from his office in Berkeley. Great to have you on Your Call, Professor Agarwal.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with this draft chapter of the TPP that was released by WikiLeaks last week. This is a real rare look inside this process that has been so closed to outside eyes. Myra, let's start with you. Kind of tell us, how did this come to pass that we actually had this document released for people to look at? And how unusual is it to get this kind of perspective?
So the last leak of the intellectual property chapter we had was from February 2011. And all of our analysis based upon the access to medicine issues, to the internet freedom issues, was based on a very outdated, you know, two-year-old text. And so having this draft was really significant for us to know both what's on the table being negotiated and what the country positions are. If you see the text, you can see, you know, which countries are proposing what text, which countries are opposing what text. And this text likely came about because one brave person decided to, you know, break their non-disclosure agreement, their NDA, to release the text and release it to WikiLeaks. And and the secrecy, part of the secrecy, is that they have been very confidential about and very strict about who sees the text, as you said. And WikiLeaks, working with Public Citizen and various nonprofit groups around the world, worked to make sure this text would not reveal who it was and make sure it was in the best format possible for publication online.
So, Ben Beachy, I mean, you try to make sense of what's going on in this process from outside with so little information in your work at Public Citizen. What for you, when you saw this leaked document, what really jumped out is like, oh, this is information we didn't have from what we knew 2.5 years ago, the last time we got this inside look?
Well, the first thing that jumps out is it just really makes clear what we've been saying for a while, which is that this deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is not fundamentally primarily about trade, as it's been traditionally defined. Free trade is typically thought of as the free exchange of goods across borders. This leaked text grant extensions on monopoly protections for a select few. So it advances the very special interests that supposedly free trade deals are supposed to knock down.
So give us a couple specific examples.
Sure. In this case, it's the pharmaceutical corporations that are getting their special interests represented. So, for example, one of the things we saw the United States proposing was that an ability to patent surgical procedures, not just medicines, but actually to have a monopoly patent for a company on a surgical procedure, which means basically that which a surgeon does beyond just using their bare hands could be patented under. If the U.S. gets its way under this deal, you know that such extraordinary proposals, which certainly are on behalf of the corporate advisors you mentioned, would really threaten to jack up the cost of medicines at a time when everyone, including the Obama administration, is trying to push in the opposite direction and make healthcare more affordable.
So, Myra Sutton, what for you jumped out? Ben Beachy was really talking about the stuff in the pharmaceutical industry at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. What were you focused on?
So there's two main issues. One is one of the most controversial that we see in this leaked chapter, which is putting liability on internet service providers and websites for users' copyright infringement. What ends up happening is those companies tend to over-censor and take down content because they're afraid of being held liable for its users' activities. The second thing is what's called anti-circumvention provisions, which is criminal liabilities for tinkering with your devices, from ebooks to your video game consoles to your computer and your phone. We have a huge issue in the United States about how unlocking your phone to change phone providers is now illegal under our own copyright law. So these sorts of provisions are supposedly there to protect copyrights of these industries. But what ends up happening is users' rights, their right to tinker, their right to free speech on the internet, all of these are threatened by these very over-restrictive provisions.
So, Professor Agarwal, I know you've been following the Trans-Pacific Partnership closely and thinking about its impacts and its implications for economies in Asia. What when you heard about what we learned from these WikiLeaks documents, what were your immediate reactions and what jumped out at you?
Well, my immediate reaction is that if you're not in the business of intellectual property creation, you're against these things. I mean, I write books. Why should somebody be able to use my book that I've worked years and years on? So Public Citizen and EFF, all of these associations are not in the business of creating knowledge. They're in the business of using it. So clearly, from a user perspective, you'd like everything free. When I spent 10 years writing a book, why should I want my book to go online for free without any protection? Now, the key point, of course, in all of this is that this whole idea that everything is secret, trade negotiations are always in secret because there are always provisions in these agreements that have to be agreed to. So if you can't negotiate publicly with everybody involved. This is not to say that societal groups don't have a right to have input into these agreements. And of course, you can always vote the agreement down if you don't like it on balance. But the whole idea, this is a complete indictment of all trade agreements. We're not going to go back to a world of inward-looking import substitution of the 19th century where nobody is allowed to trade with each other. Second, this notion that somehow this is going way beyond trade, 75% to 80% of the U.S. economy is now services. So obviously, you have to create rule for services and not for just trade and goods as our economy undergoes a transformation. You know, we can't really be troglodytes thinking about the only kinds of goods we're doing are with cavemen, selling rocks.
So, Professor Agarwal, those are great points, and I would definitely want to get a response from Myra Sutton and also from Ben Beachy at Public Citizen. I want to invite listeners to join the conversation. If you've been following the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you're just someone who's interested in how our economy works in a global context, you have questions or you've heard things you want to get more information about, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or even better, go to our website, yourcallradio.org, and leave a comment there. So Professor Agarwal raised a couple of points that I think I want you all to respond to. I mean, first, just this question of intellectual property and its protection. People who actually produce knowledge, who produce, whether it's creating a new drug or creating a new piece of software, they want it protected in the global marketplace. Why do you think the way that what we're learning about what's in the TPP doesn't do that appropriately? Let's start with you, Myra Sutton.
Well, we are not advocating against protections for, or software or books or anything like that. We're saying that the provisions that are being pushed forth in trade agreements like the TPP, in bilateral agreements that we've negotiated in the past, and even in U.S. copyright law, are over-restrictive in a way that doesn't take into account of the balance between the uses of that content and the interests of the creators and innovators. So, for instance, these anti-circumvention provisions that prevent users from unlocking their phones is there because this DRM, the digital rights management, that's there to supposedly protect these copyrighted works on our phones and actually even ebooks are so restrictive that people can't even do anything with these content that they've already legitimately purchased. So that's one example of many situations in which the user side of interests are not being represented. And in addition, these very long copyright term protections that are being suggested in the TPP 70 years after the death of an author, things like that really create situations where works like books are orphaned and they get lost and are unpublishable because the question of what their protections are lost and they're not and they're sort of become untouchable. So those are just two of the issues, as I mentioned, but it's really about restoring the balance between the users and the creators.
Professor Agarwal, what do you think about that balance and that question?
Well, I mean, I think there's always a question of where the balance should be. Obviously, if you have copyright protection for 300 years, that probably is unreasonable. But, you know, to say that this is a secretive text that's dramatically going to change the whole world, I mean, you know, 50 versus 70 versus 40, and this is what negotiations are about, for number one. Number two, it's in American interest, speaking very narrowly. If you look at what's going on, the U.S. is a very important creator of intellectual property, right? Whether we're talking about the software industry or we're talking about the music industry and the like, or, you know, the academic industry, if you'd like. So if anything, you know, we're going to gain from more protection from people in China and other countries, and China's not a member of TPP because it's going to have trouble joining. But a lot of these countries, they've been knocking off American software, American kinds of goods, so American goods and services. So why do we think that it's not in our interest to have more protection when, in fact, that's what we're in the business of doing in America now? You know, we don't make apparel very much, right? 95% of our apparel is imported. So what we're actually producing is services of various kinds, and most of it is IP related. Now, I'm not an advocate for the drug companies that's saying, you know, you should not have the ability to use drugs under cases of emergencies and so on. And I think sometimes we lean too far in the interest of pharmaceuticals. But you have to go back and forth on this. And, you know, speaking as someone who creates intellectual property, I'm totally concerned that when I go to Korea, my graduate student shows me a book that was published, which turns out to be my book, which they translated without any payment of royalties to me.
I want to get Ben Beachy back into the conversation. Professor Agarwal, I just want to ask you, though, when it comes to that question, the balance between users and creators of intellectual property, if the users aren't advising the negotiation, doesn't that tend to put it out of balance?
They are advising the negotiations. People have, if you look, a Public Citizen has been issuing reports for the last 2 years. During the negotiations, I mean, Public Citizen is not sitting at the table, which I think is reasonable, but the corporations are not sitting at the table either. They're advising, and I think Public Citizen and EFF and everyone should have a right to say what their view is. I write op-ed pieces, sometimes criticizing the pharmaceutical industry, sometimes supporting them and different groups. So I think there is an open process, and in fact, if you look at what's going to go on in terms of ratification of trade agreements, that's a very open process, and the congressmen are lobbied by different groups on different sides. But, you know, it's not like we're on the sides of the angels versus the sides of the devil.
Professor Agarwal, that's Vinod Agarwal, who is Professor of Political Science and Director of the Berkeley Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Studies Center. He's on the line from Berkeley. Also with us is Myra Sutton. She's a global policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Ben Beachy, who's a research director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Ben, you're joining us from Washington, D.C. Do you feel like you have a seat at the table in this process?
No, of course we don't. You know, you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, there's somewhere between 600 and 700 cleared official trade advisors in a trade advisory system that's existed for several decades now. These people have privileged access. They have unparalleled access to the texts themselves, the texts that have been that are not public, U.S. proposals even for the TPP is run by these people. There's a secure online site, as was revealed by a GAO report. They also have unparalleled access to negotiators. Public citizens does not have a seat at that table, by and large, public interest groups, whether they be environmental, labor, consumer, public health, freedom of information groups, do not have a seat at that table. The vast majority, I've actually crunched the numbers, I've looked at the members, the vast majority of that 600 to 700 advisors are an explicit representation of corporations. So they're there with a clear purpose. Just to give you one example, I counted a grand total of two advisors in that list of between 600 and 700 official advisors that actually represent consumer groups. Public Citizen is not one of them. General Electric alone has four advisors in the system, so it's vastly outweighed.
Who are the public interest groups that are getting that access?
Consumers Union, for example, is one of the two groups.
Okay.
But the general point, is that to talk about engagement, we can put out as many well-documented memos as we'd like. If we're not looking at the text as it exists, as it's being proposed, which is, what these cleared advisors are able to look at, then we have then the odds are stacked against us. We're opining on something that is, as was mentioned, on a leaked text that might be 2 years out of date, as opposed to what's actually being negotiated right now.
This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we are talking about the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They're going on right now in Salt Lake City. Not getting a huge amount of coverage, but something we want to delve into as best we can. Last week, there was a draft document of one of the chapters of the TPP that was released by WikiLeaks. We're talking about some of those specifics and also the bigger process and asking how trade negotiations should be carried out in a democratic system. We got folks on the line at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Also emailing in at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go first to Harvey from Berkeley. Harvey, welcome to Your Call.
Thanks, Matt, and hello to your guests. Well, first of all, I want to tell you about a great website. It's called flushthetpp.org. flushthetpp.org. They simply line out what are the problems there. But one of the problems that I find, besides the privatization of the commons and the loss of sovereignty, I don't know why the politicians are selling out their own power, but during NAFTA, what happened was that we had free trade with Mexico, and American agriculture shipped down all this really cheap corn, and the local indigenous farmers couldn't keep up with it, and a lot of them had to give up farming, and a lot of them actually became illegal immigrants to Canada. Illegal immigrants to America. Well, it turns out that the prisons for profit, the two main types of workers they liked was the ones caught for drugs because they weren't violent, and the immigrants, the illegal immigrants. So they ended up working in our prisons for profit. There's a lot of indigenous peoples in these countries, and they're going to bring in and undercut them. The death for indigenous peoples and the taking over the corporations. And I feel that this is so wrong. So, it turns out that fascism was when corporations take over. So I guess this is the fascist's latest jab, take over the world. So flush the TPP.org. Flush the TPP.org.
Right. Harvey, thank you so much for the call and for your perspective. I mean, I guess I do kind of want to ask. I mean, one thing I think it's important to kind of ask in this is, I mean, it's been a bipartisan effort to say, you know what, the executive, you handle this. We don't want to be involved in a kind of ongoing basis in trade negotiations. I mean, this has been, and as Professor Agarwal says, sometimes negotiations work best when they aren't being constantly commented on in the public space. And given how little gets done in Washington about a lot of other critical issues, I mean, I guess I'd want to ask each of you, what's the right way to do this? I mean, and I understand, Professor Agarwal, you're not criticizing so sharply the way things are now, but maybe there's some changes you suggest. But I mean, maybe starting with you, Myra, what are the, if we wanted to do this the right way, what would it look like? Setting aside the specifics of what's going to be negotiated, how should it be done?
I mean, I think, first of all, we need to think about what the goals of the agreements would be. I mean, the thing about TPP and many other agreements is that, well, at least TPP, is they're already negotiating as if they have this, it's called fast-track authority, which which circumvents congressional authority over U.S. trade policy. Congress has the constitutional authority to decide which countries we negotiate trade agreements and what topics that we negotiate with them on. And all of that has already been preempted by the U.S. Trade Office, which is under the executive branch of government. So to start off, I mean, is to really think about what issues are we directly trying to address, have public hearings, have hearings that the public can comment on, participate in, and have, you know, maybe expert witnesses that determine what those needs are and what policies we can use to try to address those issues. And none of that has been public. So, of course, the United States has already, in a lot of ways, decided what those priorities are before anything has been made public and had been debated by Congress. So, you know, the first step is to really decide what the priorities are. And I think by already deciding which countries we're negotiating TPP with and what provisions we're negotiating, those priorities have already been decided.
So last week, actually, 151 House Democrats voiced their opposition to giving the Obama administration fast-track authority when it comes to the TPP. And there's a group of 22 Republican members of the House that are also circulating a letter along those lines. Ben Beachy, you're in D.C. Do you kind of see some raising consciousness about this and some questions being raised? And also, yeah, what if you were creating the ideal process, what would you add to what Myra had to say?
Sure, I'll go with your second question first, which is, you know, we need text. In a legal binding agreement that is really difficult to alter after it's been signed, commas matter. The actual words on paper really matter, and so we need to have the text. There's not, unlike what was suggested earlier, this is not unprecedented. The Bush administration and the last similarly sweeping so-called trade deal, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, while that was under negotiation, the Bush administration published online the draft negotiating text, much like what was leaked last week, but for the entirety of the text, for anyone to see. And, you know, they said they didn't see that as a threat because we're not asking for secretive positions that have not already been revealed to our negotiating partners to be revealed to us. We're asking just to see what our negotiating partners have already seen, what is already on the table. And the Bush administration did that by publishing online for anyone to review the full text of that deal. So all we're asking for here with the TPP is for the Obama administration to uphold the same standard of transparency exhibited by the Bush administration.
Well, we're going
to answer the other question about, like, you know, what was conveyed by that letter last week of 151 Democrats saying that they're not going to give the Obama administration this blank check authority to fast track the TPP through Congress. It's really created quite a stir. In fact, in addition to that letter, there was 27 members of the Republican Party that said also we're not going to give Obama a fast-track authority, largely on constitutional grounds. As was mentioned, the Constitution gives exclusive authority just to Congress over trade policy. And really, this is not surprising. Members of Congress are seeing that, you know, this deal implicates everything from the cost of medicines and, you know, internet freedom, as has been mentioned, but also, you know, financial regulation, Wall Street reform, food safety, there are provisions in there that empower foreign corporations.
Ben,
it's a highly controversial deal. Congress wants to look at it. Even members who have voted for most trade agreements that they've seen are saying no to fast track because they simply are
Ben
saying,
Beachy,
we have to take.
We're going to be going to a break here in just a moment. We're going to get more from you and also hear from Professor Agarwal and more from Myra Sutton. We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership here on Your Call.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We invite you to join in today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org and also listen to all of our past shows there and share programs like this one with other folks you think would like to hear them. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about food banks and how they are faring in light of $5 billion cuts to the food stamp program and the increased need that generally comes around this time of year. And on Thursday, we're going to be talking about digital currencies and how they're going to impact the future of our economy. There's a lot of discussion about this on Capitol Hill for the first time right now, and so we're going to give you some information about digital currency and the potential implications. Today, we are talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is a major trade deal being negotiated. Actually, they're right now. Negotiators are meeting in Salt Lake City, and that involves the United States as well as 11 other countries around the Pacific Rim, including Japan, Canada, Mexico, Malaysia, Vietnam, and others. And we welcome you into this conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you have questions about what is on the table in these negotiations, if you want to talk about the way trade policy is set, we welcome your calls. And also, if you're in one of the industries that has really had a seat at the table, pharmaceuticals, software, entertainment, and you have comments you want to make about how intellectual property is handled in global trade, we welcome your perspective. 866-798-8255 or feedback at yourcallradio.org. With us are Ben Beachy, Research Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, Myra Sutton, who's a Global Policy Analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Professor Vinod Agarwal, who's a Professor of Political Scientist and Director of Berkeley's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Studies Center. And Professor Agarwal, I wanted to come to you with the same question that I asked both Myra and Ben, and that is about, are there ways you think that this system could be improved for the way we actually carry out these negotiations?
Yes, all systems can definitely be improved, but let me address some of these points that were made. First is it's completely true that Congress had authority to make trade policy. It's also true when Congress had that authority and implemented that authority in 1930, we had the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which is a 65% tariff that aggravated the Great Depression. And in fact, it was Congress in 1934 that decided to turn over authority on a temporary basis to the executive so it could engage in negotiations for trade agreements, because typically what happened is when you have 435 congressmen working on these issues, each special interest group, whether it's, you know, textile protectionism or IP protectionism or whatever, has a voice and everyone is able to block it. So the precedent of having the whole Congress involved from the beginning is a terrible one, and I would not advocate that for anybody. Second, I find it rather ironic to talk about the FTAA as being run by the Bush administration and what a success it was. It was never concluded. The Free Trade Area of the Americas was never signed. And I'm not saying that's the only reason it wasn't signed, but that's kind of bizarre to use that as an example of how well things work. Trade negotiations since 1934 have always taken place with fast-track authority, and the Congress has complete power to reject the agreement. The point is, nobody would negotiate with the United States if every single agreement could be amended after other countries have already made concessions to the United States. Another point is, this is not just about intellectual property. The way the discussion has gone, it's all about IP because of the people who are on the call. This is also
well, and because of the information that we have access to, right?
Yeah, but there are other issues that are very important, such as the government procurement code, where governments are preventing American firms from selling in those markets.
So, Professor Agarwal, we're going to get into the broader elements of the TPP. We will definitely do that.
We'll talk about those at some point.
Yes, but what I want to ask you is, how would you change this?
Well,
what
I
are
think,
ways you would change?
I think a lot of these groups, public citizens. Group. I'm a public citizen. I'd like to be able to say some things and send in reports and things like that. And I think that's a democratic process of the United States. But once the negotiations are going, I don't think we should have access to the text all the time. And I don't think any corporation has access to the full text. And if they did, I think that's unfair. I agree with that point.
Professor Agarwal, thank you so much. We have a lot of folks on the phone. I want to get a very quick response from Ben Beachy to what you said about the FTAA. Is that not an example, as Professor Agarwal says, of where kind of openness in the process actually led to it going aground?
Well, I'm just, you know. if the inverse of that argument is that, you know, a deal must be closed so as to be able to hide the provisions that, were they to be exposed to the public, would be so egregious that the deal would falter and it would never be signed. obviously, our whole point is that if it's such a good deal, then you have nothing to hide. The FTAA broke apart because it was not a good deal, because they didn't hide it. They showed that they're the contents of the deal, and not just within the United States, but negotiating parties said this is not a good deal. With the TPP, actually the outgoing, the former U.S. Trade Representative made a similar assertion, saying, you know, you need to keep these trade deals in the dark sometimes to get them done. That is exactly the premise that we're arguing against, that you cannot expect to keep the Congress and members of the public in the dark about such a sweeping deal. If you have nothing to hide, show us.
Well, Ben Beecher, we always keep our lines open here on Your Call, and I want to hear from Susie in San Carlos, who called in with a question at 866-798-8255. Susie, thanks for joining the program.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to, again, I haven't heard the whole program, and I was catching bits of things that are sort of on line of what I was calling about. But my understanding is that one of the major issues is that corporations will have so much power that they can actually sue a state or a country for not allowing their goods or whatever to be represented. I work a lot on labeling GMOs, and we got involved in this because we realized that if this goes through, it'll eclipse any labeling that people would have, because a corporation can say, well, you're not allowing our goods to be well represented in your country, so we can sue you. To me, that is really frightening. And how could, as one of the other callers say, how could even the Congress or any part of the government allow the government to be so taken over by corporations?
Susie, I want to get a response to your point. Myra Sutton, TPP allowing the basis for lawsuits against regulations?
Yeah. So, of course, the leak chapter last week is one of 29 chapters. And one other chapter that's in the TPP is on investments. And this investment chapter would empower corporations to sue countries over any regulation that cuts into their profits. It's really that clear cut. Last month, a pharmaceutical company, Eli Lilly and Co., sued the country of Canada over a medicine patent ruling that found that two patents were not generic, and they were challenging that decision. And so they're suing for $500 million. The country of Ecuador, under another trade agreement, was ruled against for preventing a oil exploration company from mining for oil in Ecuador, and they were trying to protect the Amazon, and due to that, there was a $2 or $3 billion ruling against the country of Ecuador, and so if you're a developing country, and many of the countries that are involved in the TPP are developing countries, these sorts of proceedings can be disastrous for your country. And if you just get a notice of intent for that a corporation is going to sue your nation, then the lawmakers of that country might not make that legislation that is meant to protect its users, its environment, or the health of its people based upon that threat that, you know, such a ruling would bankrupt their whole country to pay back a corporation. So the EFF is concerned about this investor state provision because, of course, that Eli Lilly case in Canada has shown that intellectual property is not exempt from these sorts of proceedings. And so we're afraid that, you know, maybe Disney or some content industry might challenge some internet freedom provision under the grounds that it undermines their, you know, copyright protections.
Professor Agarwal, you head up the Berkeley Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Study Center. Looking at a deal like this, I mean, we often look at it through the lens of the United States and maybe a couple of the other major partners. When you look at a deal like this from those smaller developing countries who are at the table in Salt Lake City right now, what is their interest and what's most important to them? And I know one of the interesting things about this leaked document via WikiLeaks is we got to see who was advocating for what within these negotiations. So, yeah, think. What's your perspective about how they approach these negotiations?
Well, yeah, I think this is a broad issue. I mean, it seems that, you know, a lot of these groups, the public citizens and so on, are just against trade completely. So I really find this very problematic. I mean, if you're a small country and you're very inward-looking and you have no trade with anybody, that's a disaster for small countries. In fact, all studies show that small countries are the ones that benefit more from free trade than large countries. That's the first thing that's very clear. Now, within that, you do need protections. I'm not saying that every small country should be prevented from knocking off drugs. On the other hand, you don't want people just making copies of your drugs and not being able to sell anything. We seem to be missing a very important point, that the United States is not becoming one of the world's largest producers of intellectual property. We don't make much else. So what these groups are advocating is that the U.S. should make things that anybody can knock off. I find that bizarre.
Well, I think part of the question is about who, I mean, when it comes to intellectual property, the question is, what I'm asking is for these countries, which are on the other, you know, they're the importers of that intellectual property. How do they approach it? What's your thought about how they think about it?
Well, some countries would like to be able to take the intellectual property without paying for it. I mean, there are well-known cases where they were knocking off drugs, and at the same time, they're buying weapons and saying, we can't afford the drugs. Now, whether multinationals should charge huge amounts for drugs, I'm against a lot of that, too. So I think what we're not getting here is some balance. This is not about, you know, we should destroy all of corporate America, and we should have no trade.
No, we're trying to talk about specifics.
Countries go, you know, people should be protected. I find this bizarre.
Well, it's
of
not.
Of course, they should be protected.
Well, but we're actually talking about some specifics in this agreement that could have implications for those larger issues.
I think we should talk about specifics.
I want to get Ben Beachy in there. When you're thinking about when it comes to, say, pharmaceuticals, have there been abuses of the patented pharmaceuticals that make it so that actually they aren't available in a safe form, or it discourages research and development? I think, which is the kind of what Professor Agarwal is arguing from the side of the intellectual property producers.
Yeah, look, I mean, as was mentioned earlier, there needs to be a balance. And users of so-called intellectual property are not just, you know, the Vietnamese. There are people here in the United States as well. These medicine provisions, which are really some of the most far-reaching, handouts to pharmaceutical corporations to allow them to lengthen their monopoly protections of any trade deal we've seen. I'll give you one example. There's a so-called data exclusivity proposal that the pharmaceutical corporations have been pushing very hard. The United States is currently considering it. As we understand it, though we haven't seen the text, the most recent text since August, so we don't know yet whether or not they've tabled it. But they would lock in 12 years of data exclusivity protections for cancer battling drugs that are called biologics. This essentially gives a pharmaceutical company the ability to have a monopoly protection without a patent for 12 years. Now, the thing in question here is that 12-year period. That's currently U.S. law, but the Obama administration itself has proposed reducing that to 7 years, which means that generics could come onto the shelves sooner, which means that the cost of drugs for biologic drugs here in the United States, which are life-saving medicines, would be cheaper for U.S. consumers. And the reason that the Obama administration proposed that was because reducing from 12 to 7 would save about $4 billion over the next 10 years in Medicare and Medicaid expenses. But if the Obama administration's trade negotiators succeed in granting what the pharmaceutical corporations have asked for and putting 12 years of monopoly protections for pharmaceutical companies into this so-called trade deal, it will lock that in and will go against the administration's own proposal to save us all on the cost of medicines.
That's the voice of Ben Beachy. He's research director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Also with us on Your Call today, where we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is Myra Sutton. She's a global policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation here in San Francisco, and Professor Vinod Agarwal, who is the director of the Berkeley Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Study Center. And we welcome your calls at 866-798-8255. We also are taking your emails at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to read a couple that have come in. Tim in San Francisco says, this seems like the corporate wish list for a new global legal structure. Any country that has environmental or labor laws that interfere with maximized profits can be ignored with impunity. It's really the end of the sovereign state approach to running the world. Thank you for that, Tim. Also, an email from Rob who says, as long as the Disney Corporation still owns Mickey Mouse, the copyright lifespans span laws will be extended. Thank you for doing this show. Well, thank you for writing in, Rob. And let's go to the phone where we have George from Belmont wanting to join the program. Welcome, George.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. I heard a discussion of this, of TPP, on the radio, on your air, Harry Shearer's program, a couple of weeks ago, and I was listening to the description of TPP, and what immediately came to mind was the Multilateral Agreement on Investment from the 1990s. This seems to be the MAI rearing its bloodied head once again. It was being negotiated in secret starting in 1995 in the OECD, and it was leaked. A 1997 negotiating draft was leaked by somebody to the press in 1998, and as soon as sunlight shone on it, it shriveled up and died like a vampire.
Well, George, Ben Beach, who works with Public Citizen, has been paying attention to these issues for a long time. I'm sure he knows the MAI well. Ben, how would you compare the two? And maybe this gives us an opportunity to talk about what the breadth of the TPP is and some of the issues that maybe haven't been getting as much attention as, say, intellectual property.
Sure. Well, the MAI actually goes back to, which was, the MAI, by the way, was defeated because of how extraordinary the provisions were. And yet many of those same provisions are now being proposed for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This gets back to, what Myra was mentioning with regard to the investor-state provisions of the deal. There was a leaked investment chapter, as she mentioned. What it really does is it empowers foreign corporations to completely circumvent our domestic courts and go to three-person tribunals. These are three private attorneys who get to determine whether or not our policies, our environmental, healthcare policies, are valid, or if they violate the corporation's claim to expected future profits. And if it's the latter, then taxpayers have to pay. This is a really extraordinary provision that really trumps rule of law, it trumps sovereignty. And in addition to what Myra mentioned, what's really worrisome to us about the system is that while it's existed on the books for decades, it's really corporations have been using it far more. The UN reports that today there are about twice as many cases being filed against governments and against health and environmental policies by foreign corporations under these extraordinary provisions than were filed one decade ago. And they're increasingly attacking a wider array of policies, everything from the healthcare and environmental policies that Myra mentioned. Philip Morris is going against Australia's plain packaging on anti-smoking policies. You have a corporation going against Germany's decision to phase out nuclear power. And so really the concern here is that here at home, if we're signing this deal, there are about 14,000 subsidiaries of parent companies that are based in TPP countries, any one of which could essentially sue the United States government if these extraordinary provisions go through over any policies that inhibit their expected future profits. That is what we defeat in the MAI and is what we're trying not to expand through the TPP.
Ben Beachy, I want to go to one of our callers. That is Aaron in Oakland, who is called in to your call. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Oh, hi. Good morning. So I want to challenge one of the professor's arguments about fairness to innovators and fairness to creators of intellectual property, because my understanding is that with the drug companies in particular, that there's a large percentage of public funding that goes into the development of new drugs, and then they sort of get to reap the patent harvest from the total investment, much of which is coming from the public. So it's as if he used the example of his own book. It's as if the public had helped you write your book, but only you get to reap the profits. So I really question this the argument that you were making earlier.
Aaron, why don't you hold on, and we'll get Professor Agarwal to respond.
Well, I mean, I think the issue of whether or not we should have, I mean, why have any patent rights at all? I mean, why have any intellectual property right at all? Why don't we create a situation where nobody should be encouraged to do anything? We can just have consumers using whatever they want.
Well, Aaron's bringing up a very specific question.
It's a very specific point. So, I mean, on a very specific point, whether corporations that should have public funding should be allowed to have patents, yeah, I don't think they should maybe have very long patents if they're completely publicly funded. I'm not here to defend American, pharmaceutical interests. I have lots of problems with it. I teach courses criticizing them all the time. What we're getting here is a kind of anti-capitalist rhetoric, which is not really about TPP at all. Right? I mean, the issue is TPP is just one of many trade agreements. You are also negotiating TTIP with Europe. We're negotiating lots of agreements. Now, if you say, look, you know, we should not include intellectual property in trade agreements, well, that's something that needs to be debated openly, and I think that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. Some economists think that intellectual property should not be protected as much as it is in international trade agreements. I actually agree with some of those points. But this is not about TPP. This is about general, very specific provisions. We've made the whole thing about one leaked text that has come out of TPP.
So what?
I find this bizarre.
So what aren't we talking about that we should?
What's that?
What aren't we talking about that we should?
No, we're not talking about lots of things in the trade agreement. There's government procurement. There's
okay. Let's take that one. So what's important to talk about there, and what would you tell people?
The Chinese, for example, let's talk about in our negotiations with the WTO. The Chinese have never signed the government procurement code, which means that they have to open up bidding to American companies, European companies, and the like. So what they've used is industrial policy to essentially favor their own companies. And I think that's not very good for American companies or European companies who are trying to enter the Chinese market. And what it is you have Chinese domination because Chinese dominant companies are able to succeed because the government only purchases from them. That's a very important issue.
Of course, China's not in this particular negotiation.
No, but it would like to join potentially, and China's been in the WTO negotiations. The same issue comes up. TPP's issues, many of them have
well,
already
let's
been discussed
get,
in the
So
WTO.
I want to hear from either Ben or Myra talking about this question of government procurement.
Sure, I'm happy to take a stab at it. So government procurement, one of the ways this comes into play is Buy American. Buy American is a provision that says that, you know, when the United States government procures goods, whether it's like building a new bridge, doing a lot of the infrastructure improvements that President Obama has talked about, that those goods be made by U.S. companies. This is something that polls have shown are supported by 90% of Republicans, 90% of Democrats, and 90% of independents. So it's a broad bipartisan support for these provisions. And we would, you know, say that other countries should have this prerogative as well to show that, you know, to spur local job creation. What the Trans-Pacific Partnership would do would be to ban Buy American with regard to companies that are operating in any other TPP country. That is, if a foreign company that's operating in, say, a Chinese company is operating in Vietnam and then comes over to and bids on a contract with the United States, the United States, under the terms of the deal that have been proposed, would be banned from ensuring preferential treatment for U.S. companies to spur local job creation and funnel U.S. taxes that are going to be paying for that bridge back into the U.S. economy. That's it's a net loss. On the other side, you know, oftentimes there's the argument made that, well, you know, U.S. companies would also get greater access to the procurement markets in other TPP countries as well. But even if you take the most favorable cut on other countries' markets, the total U.S. procurement market is about twice the size of the combined procurement market of other TPP negotiating parties. So it's a real loss to the United States to lose those Buy American provisions.
Myra Sutton, what would you add?
Yeah, so I wanted to address something that Professor Aguilar said in the beginning of his statement about us being against all patent and copyright protections. I mean, one of the issues is that these industries, the movie industries, aren't taking advantage of the huge opportunities that new technologies have allowed. I mean, there's this great site called Piracy Data, and it looks at the top 10 most downloaded movies online, or illegally downloaded movies online, and checks to see if those are available for streaming and download. And almost none of them are. I mean, and that really goes to show how these industries are really, really They're unable to shift and evolve the actual reality of technology, and people have very different expectations about their experience with content and with their devices because, you know, that's just the reality of what technology has allowed us. And so the issue here is that these companies should really be exploring how to meet the demand that's truly there rather than trying to use law to restrict and monopolize the market in the way that they're trying to do with these copyright laws.
I have a real problem with that. I mean, I guess you've never heard of Spotify or Netflix.
Well, no. I mean, those models have succeeded because they are trying to innovate. But even those businesses have faced very, very huge barriers in battling restrictive copyright provisions.
Professor Agarwal, 30 seconds.
Right to watch a movie without paying for it?
Sorry, repeat that?
So I should have the right to download any movie I want without paying for it?
No, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the studios should provide avenues for legally doing so, and they're not.
It's called Netflix. It's called Amazon. There are lots of companies that are now doing that. I mean, the fact that these companies have been in transition, I think, you know, maybe they've been slow to do it, but they are transitioning to a different model.
So, Professor Agarwal, we're going to have to leave it there. TPP, this is a huge... it's a huge potential agreement that is being talked about by negotiators right now in Salt Lake City. I encourage folks who want to learn more to go to our website, yourcallradio.org, to learn more. I want to thank our guests who are on the program, Myra Sutton with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Vinod Agarwal, professor of political science at Berkeley and head of their Berkeley Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Study Center. Thank you so much, Professor Agarwal.
Thank you.
And also Ben Beachy, research director. Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Thank you, Ben, for joining the program.
Thank you for covering this.
You are very welcome, and I want to thank everyone who called in or sent emails. You're welcome to continue the conversation at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and coming up on the program tomorrow, in just a moment, you'll be hearing what's coming up. Thanks. How are food banks coping with increasing demand? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about food banks and how they're faring since the latest major cuts to the federal food stamps program. Holidays are approaching, and local food banks say they're seeing more demand than ever. So how are they keeping up? If you work in food banks or get food from one, call us with your questions, ideas, and experiences. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Hannah Baba and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.